Three messages before we get started. First, do you need a single phone number that comes with multiple extensions so anyone who works at your company can be reached no matter where they are? Go to grasshopper.com. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. Next, does anyone you know need a beautiful online store that actually increases sales but is easy to set up and manage? Send them to shopify.com. The platform that top online stores are running on right now. Finally, do you need a lawyer who actually understands the startup world that you and I live in? Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. I've known Scott Edward Walker for years, so tell him you're a friend of mine and he'll take good care of you. Here's the program. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, home of the ambitious upstart, and the place where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. They come here to tell you their stories, to fire you up, to inspire you, to give you a few ideas, and to set you off on a path that will hopefully lead to you being right here where you tell your story one day and inspire and help other people. And in this interview, I want to find out how a guy who listened to a self-help tape ended up building a multi-million dollar company. When he was 19, Don Ciclary heard a tape that told him to write down how much money he wanted to earn. He wrote down a number that he thought was really high back then, $50,000. Well, turns out it set him on the right path and it sensitized him to what he wanted out of life. And as a result, partially of that experience, today, Don is the founder and head of InCheck, which offers payment processing services, including credit card processing, remote check deposit, and collections. Don, welcome and thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to be here.
How much revenue are you doing? I said multi-million dollar company. Be a little more specific if you could.
We're in the seven figures. We haven't hit eight yet. We're in the seven figures, so I'm pretty happy with that.
What do you mean you haven't hit it yet? You're doing over $1 million in sales a year, right?
Yeah, we haven't hit eight figures yet.
Oh, you haven't hit eight figures, and that's the next goal.
We're in seven figures. We haven't hit eight figures yet.
Okay. And you started off with how much?
$250.
$250. That's what you invested in this business.
It's all I had, man. I was in college. It was, you know.
And partially the reason that you went off and started your company is, well, a friend of yours told you that you had the personality for sales. What did he mean by that?
Well, he had a company that was doing a check processing technology at the time. This is in the early 2000s. And they were looking for sales guys. And apparently he had a personality that he thought would work for sales. We were firefighter EMTs together. And so I said, sure, why not? I'll give it a shot. I don't know anything about sales or checks or business. I'm living on, you know, a few hundred dollars a month, which is what I was making as a paid per call volunteer firefighter. So why not?
And before then, did you think that you were going to be an entrepreneur or get into business?
Well, I didn't think so. My dream was to be a doctor, but apparently there's a picture of me at 6 years old holding a briefcase. My grandfather was a CPA. My father was a CPA. So apparently there's this business bug gene in my family. But my dream from the time I was young was to be a doctor, hence okay. the paramedic thing and so forth.
What was it about your personality that made you suited for sales?
I guess I was friendly and outgoing. I really don't know.
All right. Were there points in your life where you saw it come out? Because I remember for myself, I was a big nerd. But there were times when we talk business or I would go work for a guy named Paul Cervera in Manhattan. I could actually make sales calls where I felt like I see a glimpse of who I could be. Were there examples like that for you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I was really fortunate to have some really incredible mentors in my teen years. So I was looking up to them from a very young age. And I always had a thing for networking. I always wanted to meet people that were more successful and more accomplished than I was. I didn't become jealous. I became sort of envious in the sense that I wanted to know how they do what they do.
For example, who was it that made you say, how did he do it, instead of, damn him, why did he do it?
Well, I have one mentor in particular that encouraged me to start this company. He was my martial arts teacher, and this is a guy who had run an advertising agency, done really well with that, started a martial arts school, did really well with that, went on to become a bodyguard for royal families, did really well with that, and then went off to work with Microsoft with Bill Gates. So this is somebody who kind of just starts something, becomes the best in the world at what he does, and then does something else. And I kind of went, well, that's cool. And he really turned me on to the idea of resourcefulness and networking. you know, being able to find the resources to do the things I wanted to do. But I remember he introduced me to an investment banker. And this was, at the time, somebody who I considered ultra wealthy. And I remember I was so afraid to meet this guy because I didn't know, I thought he'd come out in a suit, you know, all put together. And he shows up in a big flannel shirt and jeans, you know, and I kind of went, huh, when you really reach the top and you're successful, because I was, you know, like 20 years old, and I would wear a suit everywhere because I was dealing with clients who were 2-3 times my age. I almost said four, but that's getting a little there. but I was really intimidated. I mean, I was just this young kid, and so I always wanted to look put together. I'd always be in a suit and so forth. And then I met this particular man, and I was like, wow, people who really make it don't have to do that. They can do whatever they want. And that was a paradigm changer for me. And then, of course, later on, you know, because my industry, the financial industry, has been still pretty conservative. Later on, I went out west to our favorite city there, San Francisco, and realized that, you know, people weren't people on the West Coast did things a little differently. But anyway, the I think those two, you know, that first mentor of mine and then the investment banker he introduced me to, who was, you know, he was talking about staggering numbers. I mean, he would say things like, you know, you don't want to sell your company when it hits 25 million. You want to wait till it's worth 250 million. And I'm like, I have $250. That's, you know.
And that makes you feel, oh, there's a bigger world of possibilities out there than I ever imagined. Something mm-hmm. bigger to strive for.
So yeah, so it was a process of mind opening, you know, through my 20s from kind of the mindset I grew up with, which is you work really hard and long, to the idea that all possibilities are endless, and it's what you're open to and what you draw to you that arrives.
Who was it whose tape you were listening to get yourself prepared to get into business?
So you reminded me of this story today because I forgot about it. I went to school in Ohio, and I was driving home late at night on Route 80 from Ohio back to Connecticut, listening to Brian Tracy sales tapes. I don't remember anything else that he said in this whole series of 12 tapes. There were cassettes at the time. Or maybe they were DVDs. Maybe they were CDs. I think they were cassettes. But anyway, he said, you know, Brian, he's really enthusiastic. And he said, pick a number of what you want to make this year and write it down. And I did.
And how long did it take you to get to that number?
I really don't remember. It probably took me, probably the year after, mm-hmm. Because this would have been in the summer of that year. So maybe the year after or sometime early the year after that. I really don't recall what we were doing in our really early days.
But it changed you to start thinking that way? How?
Yeah, because the number was $50,000. And at that point, that was an unfathomable amount of money to me. So I was like, wow, if I make $50,000, I could go on a cruise. I remember telling my mom, we're going to go on a cruise this year.
All right. So then this guy gives you an opportunity, says, hey, I'm looking for salespeople. You have the personality to be in sales. What was it that you were going to sell and how did you do there?
All right. So we were doing check processing services. Mm-hmm. Basically, if a retail store received a bad check, they'd be mailed to us to the company from their bank. We would notify the client, and then we would essentially verify funds in the check writer's account and represent the check. So I was going out door to door.
I'm sorry. Can you explain that to me before we started so I have a clear understanding of it? But can you say that again a little bit slower so that people understand what this business was?
Sure. So retail store takes a check. Somebody mm-hmm. comes in and writes a check. They deposit it in their bank. If the check is returned for non-sufficient funds or whatever reason, typically the bank would mail it back to the merchant, who would then contact a collection agency, represent it by the bank, or call the check writer. We were doing something where the bank would send the client's bad checks to our company. We would verify funds in the account, and when funds became available, we'd pull the funds electronically. So basically, it was bad check representment.
So no work for the retailer, but as soon as there's cash in his customer's bank account to make that check good, the retailer gets paid and your company that you're working for gets a percentage of that.
No, we didn't take a percentage. We took the state fee. Every state allowed a fee to be charged for a bad check. So we paid the client 100% and kept the fee. So it was a good deal for the merchants because it was free to them. There was no charge to them for it.
Okay. So first time doing sales, you were EMT before, you were going to be a doctor. How did you do in sales?
I guess I did all right. I went door to door. I called people and basically I remember going door to door. You know, I did a lot of that.
Literally door to door to what? Pizzas, pizza stores.
Just because at that time pizza places were taking a lot of bad checks. And so in fact, I remember when I started my company, I went to drove to Cincinnati and I didn't have enough money to pay for gas to get back. So I knew that I had to get someone to pay a setup fee in person, or I wasn't going to be able to admit to drive back to Oxford. And I did. So I literally would go to, like, you know, especially college areas and go door to door and ask for the person who handles bad checks, explain what we do and try to get a sign up.
I just want to make sure that the audience caught that story. Your car broke down. You didn't have enough money to have the car fixed and get yourself back home. You say, all right, I'm going to walk door to door to all the retailers that I can find. I'm going to tell them about my service. I'm going to hustle. I'm going to get enough customers to pay me that then I can get that money to fix my car and get my way home. Is that right?
Basically, the car didn't break down. I wasn't going to have enough gas to get back.
Oh, so it was even worse.
Although there was a time.
That little money.
Although there was a time when I was driving, because I drove a car that broke down every other trip between Ohio and Connecticut. So it broke down in Cleveland area, Youngstown area, and I was on the highway and the car just shut off. And it was like Saturday night at 10 p.m. I'm like, oh, crap, what am I going to do? So I got it towed to a local garage. They couldn't do anything until Monday to fix it. So I spent Sunday going door to door. And through that experience, at the time, signed my biggest client at that time, which was a chain of 12 pizza places in Youngstown.
Wow. Wow.
So I had nothing to do on Sunday, so I just went door to door.
Brian Tracy would be proud to turn lemons into lemonade, as he might have said. All right, so you are now working for this company. A few weeks later, you go and you start your own business, right? How do you get started with your own company? Same, you say, hey, you know what? I see this opportunity here. I'm going to go and create my own business in this space. How do you start your own business? What's the first step?
The inner and outer factors. I mean, there was first the inner challenges that I had to get over of whether I was felt deserving and worthy to be able to start a business.
Really?
I can discuss some of those if you'd like. But then there were the actual steps I took.
Wait, you couldn't just say to yourself, hey, there's a great opportunity here. I'm going to jump on it. These guys are doing it. I could do it too. Boom. Let's just figure out how we can get these checks paid for. No, there was an inner game. Why?
It was an inner game because I was like, you know, a teenager. So I, you know, and my clients were people, you know, a lot of grocers and pizza places, and they were much older. And I'm thinking, you know, I didn't know that I could do it. I remember sitting down with this particular mentor I mentioned in New York having lunch, and that's when he convinced me to do it. But I needed that push. I needed someone to say, you know, you can do this, because I didn't know anything about business. I didn't know about accounting. I didn't know about incorporating. I didn't know any of that stuff. I
mean, beyond the three words, you can do this. You can do this. Four words. Beyond that, what else was it that made him that he said that made you feel like you could do it? Was it that he walked you through the process and said, "Look, this is what it takes, and you can do this," or was it just, "Hey, you'll figure it out"? What else?
He did through the process a little bit, and I don't remember everything that he said, but it was how he said it. He was very encouraging. You know, it was more like the idea was you can do this. And I don't know that he said it in those words, but that was the gist of it. And then the rest of it kind of figured itself out, where I was like, okay, well, I don't have the resources to start my own company with an office and a staff and ACH access and all of that. Mm-hmm. So I found another company that was that I could outsource the processing to, and they would pay me a commission. So that's why I was able to start with no seed money. I mean, I remember going to a store and buying my first fax machine, and I was so excited because that was a big step. Because we would fax our clients notifications. So this company that I outsourced to would fax me notifications that they had received a check from the merchant's bank. And then I would turn around and create our own branded notification and fax it off to the client.
I see.
No, we were outsourcing it, but that was the only way I could do it because I didn't have any capital.
How'd you find this company that would do it for you?
Somebody else that had worked at the other company with me told me about them, I think.
I see. And was it standard for them to basically be outsourcers for upstarts like you, or was this a new idea?
No, it was standard because, you know, at that point we were basically sales reps for them. I just immediately took a more active role and interest and didn't let our clients know we were sales reps for them. So okay. It was, you know, so they had other sales reps on the street. I just kind of cloaked that and made it our service.
You're doing seven figures now. You told me you started with three figures. Where did that money go?
The three figures?
Yeah. The, what was it? $250?
Like literally, where did the 250 go?
I mean, yeah, when you have very little money, where do you put that money? Are you the kind of person who says, I have to incorporate? Or are you the kind of person who says that money needs to go towards marketing? When you have so little money and you have to start a business, where does the money go?
Okay, so it went to like 90-something of it went to a fax machine. Because what I did was I created a fax marketing package in black and white. And I printed it on my printer and I would fax it to our merchants. So I didn't have any publishing costs. So I would just print it. I'd call them on the phone and say, hey, can I fax you some information? At that point, you know, we weren't emailing and scanning as much as we are today. So it was easy to just stick the information package in the fax machine.
Gotcha.
And whether it was color or not on our end, it came out black and white on theirs. So that's how I saved a bunch of money. I didn't really have any marketing costs that way.
Okay.
The rest of it probably went to incorporating or starting the LLC, I'm guessing.
Okay. And how did you get your first customers? A guy with no background in this space, who's young, who's a teenager, who has to now say to businesses, hey, trust me with your money. Trust me with your customers' checks. How do you get that?
Some of the money probably went to business cards. I took some of the customers that I had signed with the other company because one of them was my hockey coach in high school who owned a dry cleaners, two locations. So that was one. You know, so I started off with friends or people my father knew or whatever. But then I would just go door to door and I'd say, you know, can I speak with the person who handles bad checks? Or I'd call. And this technology at the time was new and it was kind of revolutionary. So to them, it was a great idea because they no longer had to deal with the bad checks. We were doing it for them. So it was really a no-brainer to sell, but it came complete with all the usual sales stuff. You know, people would take their time, not get back to us, have every excuse in the world. So I just keep calling and calling and calling. And, you know, went to a lot of pizza places because pizza delivery was taking a lot of bad checks.
I think it was the founder of Grubhub who told me that he had to go door to door to get the first customers of his business. And one of the things that he figured out was if you go when they don't have a lot of customers and you walk through the back door, then you're more likely to get customers. I think he was the person who told me. Did you have any tactics like that that would get you around people's walls?
Yeah, it was always hard to get through the gatekeepers. And so I would, if I was walking in, I might say something like, you know, I'm in the area doing some market research and I want to get some information about, you know, what are bad checks like down here? Do you get many? And then they would start talking, you know. And then I remember saying, you know, if I would say, how do you handle your bad checks? I remember walking into a gun store and I said, how do you handle your bad checks? And the guy, you know, big, burly Ohio guy goes, well, how do you think? And I was like, you know, there's a rack of guns behind him. And, well, but I'd ask, you know, those questions. Do you get a lot of bad checks? How do you handle them? And then I would probably lead into, you know, what if there was a better way? What if you could have all these checks collected for free and it wouldn't cost you tiny time or money? Oh, okay. Well, let's hear it. And then, you know, and it wasn't really, you know, it was one of those things where people don't want to deal with bad checks. So it was something like it was taking a headache off their hands as opposed to now, you know, going door to door for the merchant processing. It's a whole different ballgame.
How much of a pain was it for them? What would they have to do as pizza owners?
To collect bad checks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Had options. They could send them to a collections agency. They could go to the bank and try to redeposit the paper, or they could call the customers. To be honest, a lot of them were just throwing them in the trash.
And they lose the money because it's not worth going to collections for what, 20, 50 bucks?
Exactly. For pizza. Exactly.
Gotcha. You said you'd walk in saying, I'm doing market research. I've heard this before too from other entrepreneurs. Was that the in? That's how you got them to pay attention? I am not here to sell. I just want to do some market research?
Or I would immediately, you know, say this is a free program. You know, and then nobody believed me, of course. Well, why is it free? I don't believe you. And I would say, you know, we get the fee from the check writer. But I remember, interestingly, this was a paradigm shifter too. our biggest check client that we had for a long time was a school photography studio. And they called me from the internet, from our website, I guess. They'd seen us. And she said to me, do you guys have a setup fee? At that point, my setup fee had gone from $25 to $40 to $99. I mean, we're talking big bucks here. I said, yeah, it's $99. She said, oh, well, this other company doesn't have one, so there must be something wrong with them. So I'm going to sign with you. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, because the other company was much bigger than we were. And I'm thinking, that made me realize that people put value on things they pay for.
And so that's when you started to increase prices?
That's when we started to charge a setup fee, and then we charge an annual fee and things like that. I mean, there still was no cost for the service, but I figured, you know, somebody could pay $100 to have someone take all their checks, bad checks off their hands.
I see. Oh, so at first you didn't charge any fee at all, and that's what got you in the door, but also made you lose a little credibility.
Exactly.
All right. What about the confidence that it takes to walk in the door and say to a stranger, I want your checks. I want to even talk to you about something other than buying from you. That's not an easy thing to do. How'd you get past that?
I mean, it's like any kind of cold approach. If you're, you know, you... How did I get past that? Can we cut out the ums and...
Nope, we leave them all in there. It's okay. It makes for a much more natural conversation.
I just did. I mean, it was nerve wracking at times, but I guess I had the confidence that my service was something they needed. And knowing that, it was a matter of how do I convince them that I'm something they need?
Okay. All right.
I can't really think, it was so long ago. I can't really think of any particular, you know, like mental tricks or, you know, getting psyched up beforehand. I just did it. I just went and did it. I'd say, you know, I'm going to walk this whole block, and I'd walk in. Sometimes I hoped the owners weren't there because I didn't want to give the sales pitch. So I'd walk in and hope that I could just leave my information and say, hey, can I leave some information, have them call me. Phone was a little bit easier than walking in sometimes, but it was also harder because it's easier for someone to hang up on you than it is, you know, to slam the door in your face.
At some point you go from outsourcing to starting to do this stuff in-house. How do you do it directly and internally?
I found a company to partner with that had a relationship with a bank, and he allowed us to process our files through his company.
Okay.
Okay.
And was there ever a time, what was the next step after that for processing it? You went from fully outsourcing and just basically rewriting the faxes that you send out to now to partnering up with this company. What was the next step?
Was a direct relationship with an ACH processor, which came about, you know, a few years later.
Okay.
And continued that until checks started to decline. And we still do check processing. We still collect some bad checks for old clients. We still do remote deposit and collections. But around 2007, I'd say we started to switch more. It's 2007, 2008, switch over into electronic payments because that was coming.
Electronic payments meaning credit cards?
Debit card processing, yeah.
How did you get new customers there?
That was hard because in the retail sector of that industry, it's very cutthroat. And to this day, I've got reps on the street that are going door to door. But almost right away, we found our niche, which was internet e-commerce, high volume, high risk clients.
For example,
you know, internet marketers, folks that are selling information products online, things like that. The first one fell into my lap. I got referred from a client who's also a friend to somebody else who referred me to somebody else, and I got a call. And I thought, you know, this is a real big win for us because this is a big high volume account. And then we started doing that well, and then, you know, referrals just started coming in, and it was, you know, a lot of word of mouth at that point. And I remember reaching the point where clients were coming to me. I didn't have to go out and sell, and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool because, you know, those years I walked door to door, now I'm answering the phone.
How'd you know that credit cards were the next place to build out your business?
Well, you know, I'd like to say that I had some foresight and planned this. I didn't. It just fell into my lap. I mean, we knew checks were declining. Electronic payments were increasing. There's statistics on that. I didn't know anything about high risk. I had a friend in Olympia, Washington, who was into high risk credit cards, and he would always tell me about the opportunity. But I never wanted to get involved with the merchant processing end of things because I saw it as a lot more complicated and complex than the checks. So I just didn't want to go there. And then we did. And then I did because our clients were complaining about their credit card people. See, when I started the company, I always wanted what I called at the time the account manager model, where every client had a name of somebody at the company that they'd call and speak with personally. It was a relationship that was being built, as opposed to calling India and pressing 4, you know, and things like that. So as I began to hear complaints from our clients about their credit cards, I thought, well, you know, it's only fair for us to be able to offer that as well. So we started to do that. And then the current vertical just kind of fell in my lap one day. And I was like, wow, my friend was right. There's a lot of potential here. And then we just grew with the, you know, as internet payments grew, so did we.
Was there anything that you started in between dealing with bad checks and credit card processing that didn't work out?
Yeah, I can't say it didn't work out. I mean, we do remote check deposit. We've got some clients doing that. That was the kind of the in-between technology that was coming in.
Remote deposit, meaning a check comes in, instead of going to the bank, they go to your website and they start punching in all the information from the check. They hold on to it until the money gets to their bank. Then they cross.
But also at the time, I was doing a lot of things. I was organizing charity events in Manhattan. I was working as a paramedic. I had a bunch of things going on.
You still worked as a paramedic even while you were building up this business?
And to be honest, I sit and I'm looking forward to getting back into it in the near future. I love EMS and firefighting.
What do you love about it?
Oh, man. Well, I've had the medical bug since I was a kid, so I love the technical medicine aspects. I love the adrenaline, and I love being able to help people and being with people during what are some of, you know, the most traumatic and dramatic times of their lives and being there and being able to make a difference. And firefighting I like because I've been a martial artist, you know, for a long time, and the thing about fire is that it's an uncontrollable enemy. It doesn't have a soul. It's living and breathing, but it does what it wants. And so it's very interesting to be running into a burning building. But anyway, in fact, I remember this mentor I told you about who was the bodyguard for the royal families. When I started InCheck, I remember saying to him, hey, you know, I'd rather run into a burning building than do this bookkeeping thing and hunt for missing pennies. He said, yeah, I'd rather go to a gunfight than do bookkeeping. And he was serious. And so was I. I was doing a bunch of other things at the time. There were a few other things I was doing too. And so the company was kind of stable. It was paying my bills. But it got to a point where I was like, okay, I need to do something with this. I need to really grow this enterprise or not, you know, and I decided to. That's when my sister came aboard as a partner. She was my first employee in high school. I used to pay her $6 an hour under the table to call banks and verify funds and check writers' accounts. But she was in high school, I mean. So the things, no, there's not really anything that didn't work per se.
But you weren't fully committed to this business at the time. You weren't a guy who said, this is going to be my future. I'm going to build my fortune here. This was just bringing in some cash part time.
See, that was the mindset shift because that's how I started it. I'm going to do sales on the side. I'm going to do this so that I can go to medical school and do the things that I want to do. And that continued, you know, I had a staff early on that processed the checks. I was able to travel a lot and do a lot of other things. And it was paying my bills and supporting my lifestyle. I wasn't, you know, ready to retire on it, but that went on for a few years. And then I realized, well, you know, I don't want to be doing this forever. So I need to really build this up. And that's when we found our current niche with the high risk credit card processing and everything just took off.
It was, I don't want to do this forever that led you to build, to make InCheck into a bigger company?
Processing checks, yeah. I didn't want to deal with people.
You said, I don't want to deal with bad checks forever.
Bad checks forever. Exactly. So then.
Why? You know, what was it about it that made you feel like it wasn't the right life for you?
We were offering a service, but I felt bad dealing with all the check writers who would call and tell me their sob stories about why they bounced a check or blame me for them bouncing a check. You know, we it's my fault they bounced a check or they didn't bounce a check, even though it's sitting in front of me. And I didn't want to deal with people's bad checks, you know, and I wanted to do something more fulfilling. And ultimately the company was a means to an end for some of my philanthropic endeavors and the other things that I find even more fulfilling on a humanistic level. Humanistic spiritual level than merchant processing. But anyway, I Yeah, I knew I didn't want to just playing with bad checks, people's bad checks all day and listening to their stories of, you know, why, you know, somebody died and they had to pay for funerals and they, I mean, it's tough. It's difficult. And I'm inclined to just give them a refund because it's the kind of person I am.
Yeah.
Refund.
Yeah. It's like being in collections. There might be a lot of money in it, but man, it's painful. It's hard to live with yourself. All right. Merchant processing. My friend Casey Allen started to tell me a little bit about the business. There's a lot of money to be made in it. Tell us about the opportunity in the space that you saw.
I saw the opportunity of being more hands-on and more hands-off. So with the check stuff, we actually move the money directly. We move the money from the customer's check writer's account into our account, into the merchant's and the merchant's account, right? We don't move the money. Only the banks move the money with merchant processing because it's much more automated. So I saw the opportunity to be more hands-on in terms of building relationships with my clients. A lot of my clients are young entrepreneurs who have become friends, as opposed to, you know, dealing with a lot of grocery stores and things that were just business clients, you know. So I saw the opportunity to build stronger relationships while not having to actually move the money myself. I could spend more time building the relationship, working on the technology, being more of a consultant to my clients' businesses rather than the person that sits behind the scenes behind a computer and moves the bad check money.
I see. And you did have high-risk customers. You worked with the Asahi Berry people?
Did.
What happened there?
2009. December happened.
What happened 2009?
It was late 2009. I was getting ready to go to Affiliate Summit. And what happened was Senator Rockefeller sent a letter to MasterCard and Visa and American Express saying he didn't agree with the free trial continuity stuff. MasterCard and Visa then shut down tens of thousands of merchants in 1 week. So the industry basically got cleaned up, and it was a tough week. So most of my biggest clients were shut down that week.
How did they work? They were giving away a free sample, but you have to give a credit card in order to do shipping and handling. And once you gave a credit card, whether you were clearly aware of it or not, your card would be charged on a monthly basis and you would get something new in the mail on a monthly basis.
Yeah, you'd pay like, say, $4.95 for shipping. And then you'd pay $90 a month for a bottle of acai berry. The problem was that the affiliates were promoting it as a free offer. So for $4.95, they thought they were just getting a bottle. They didn't know they were going to be charged on a recurring basis.
Right.
Right.
That's where the problems came in. And also some of the claims that were being made, the FTC really cracked down on.
So how do you recover from something like that, losing so many customers so quickly?
We recovered because of our model. Because I knew my clients so well, I was able to work with some of them to get them up and running again by counseling them on how to do this right.
How?
Well, that's a long, complicated discourse, but basically how to properly disclose the terms and conditions, how to keep your chargebacks down by making sure you're not making outrageous claims, what the right price points are, what the right products to sell are, all these things that, you know, how to stay off the radar of the FTC by not doing something illegal, things like that. And so I worked with some of them to get them up and running again. And then we started to diversify more of our client base in terms of bringing in more retail accounts, bringing in more medium to low risk businesses, things that were more stable, and being more selective with the clients that we took. So I was able to start screening my clients. Is this someone who's in it for the long term or the short term? Because at that time, you had 19-year-old kids that were, you know, making millions in their mother's basement with the acai berry, being, you know, they were fulfilling out of a fulfillment center. They were doing customer service. Yeah. But then they were up for 3 months and they were shut down. So, you know, we're really working with my clients and being more selective.
So the reason that the space is so profitable doing merchant processing is that once you sign a customer once, you're getting a share of their revenues on an ongoing basis. The bigger they get, the bigger your share, the more valuable your share is. And it's just continuous. You go and you get new customers while your old customers keep generating revenue, right?
It's true, but it's not nearly as much as you think it is because there's about 5 or 6 hands in that pie.
What are the other hands?
People don't realize this. I'm going to put one more log on the fire because I'm getting a little colder.
It was a beautiful fire as it went.
Most people don't realize that the vast majority of that money that they're paying in merchant account fees goes to the bank that issued the credit card. So that's why you get so many offers in the mail every month. You've been pre-approved for this credit card and that credit card, because that those banks that issue the credit cards make most of the money. So the majority of it goes right back to the bank that issued the credit card.
What else? What else? By the way, where are you? That's a nice fire. I see. Is it snow out that window?
Snow out the window. I am up in the mountains of New England in my cottage. Finishing some projects and getting some things done before I head back out west for Affiliate Summit.
So you're working from that cottage. And you also, can I say this, you have a place in San Francisco that you barely live in, but it's a fun place to have and to stay connected to the tech world. It's a pretty decent life you've been able to build for yourself from InCheck.
They tell me.
Boy, if that 19-year-old who was aspiring for $50,000 would see you now, man, he would be hustling. What do you think he would be saying?
Looking at me now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'd be probably jealous.
Really?
I'm not yet. There are some other things that I want to do that I'm not totally able to do because I'm still very hands-on with the business, and I will be for a while. We did some hiring last year that didn't quite work out the way that I wanted it to. So there were some challenges there. So I'm going to be looking to build some new staff.
What were the challenges with hiring?
What's that?
What were the challenges with hiring?
I hired somebody that the goal was to be able to let him run operations. Somebody who was much older than me with more experience. And the goal was vice president of operations, someone who could run operations so that I could focus more on high level things like networking and presentations. So one of the things that I want to do more of this year is speaking on risk and internet marketing and things like that. So the goal was for me to be able to do that. And also wanted to spend some more time getting back into EMS and so forth. He just wasn't able to do the job the way that we do it. So I had to take back over operations I've got a great lifestyle. Got a few different places.
I'm sorry, you got what?
I've got a great lifestyle. I've got a few different places that I allow me to stay connected to cities that are really important to me. I spend a lot of time in Las Vegas because I started training with some Cirque du Soleil acrobats in January of last year. And I just fell in love with the training, gymnastics and acrobatics. So I'm there most of the time. I'm actually in Las Vegas.
Cirque du Soleil, martial arts, EMT, firefighting. I'm surprised the guy who's running a company would want to have all these different interests. You seem not as passionate about your business as you are about these side interests. Is that true?
No, it's not true.
Well, it's not true.
I'm not currently in firefighting and EMS. I've been out of that field for a while. Okay. But I'd like to do it.
That's
but I am pretty
passionate. I should have said EMS. Uh-huh. Okay. I'm just trying to figure out like your passion level for this work. I'm trying to figure out why and how you can do other things.
I can do other things because I've got great people because I can work from wherever I am. So I'm able to do most of my work from my laptop and cell phone.
Okay.
So I can work from wherever I'm traveling, which makes it really easy. And my clients know that they can call me anytime, 24 hours a day on my cell phone. So, that's one, I don't need to be tied to an office like I was when I was processing checks. I can move around a lot.
Okay. How much time would you say you spend on the business now?
A lot. Most of the day. Yeah. Most of the evening.
What'd you learn about hiring from the bad experiences that you've had?
We've moved on that. We're in a pretty big growth phase right now. So, I'm putting really a lot of time, into the business. But what I learned about hiring, I learned that, that's a good question. What did I learn about hiring?
One thing you seem to learn is earlier on in your career, you weren't hiring people who were older. I just noticed that the person who you were talking about a moment ago was older than you.
Beginning, I was afraid to hire anybody older than me. So I hired people that were my age or younger. And then recently, the person I hired last year was a whole bunch of years older than me, had a lot more experience and was not really able to adapt to the InCheck model of how we do things. more innovative model, more customer intense, if you will. So I guess I learned that I need to maybe work with somebody a little bit more before I give them too much of the reins. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for the right people next year, and I have some ideas of how that's going to work. Somebody that's from outside the industry that has the right mix of experience. Some people from outside the industry that I can groom and teach the industry to, who will be able to assist me. That's kind of the next step.
Okay. All right. Let me ask you something that I noticed that something happened in our conversation soon after I asked about Cirque du Soleil and your side interests. Did it come across like an insult for me to say, hey, you've got these other passions that you seem more engaged with or more passionate about than work?
It didn't come across as an insult. I don't want listeners to think that, you shouldn't put time and commitment and effort and focus into starting a business, because by all means you have to. And one of the things that I could talk about is what made the difference when we started to really grow is when I decided that, that I was going to put a period of very intense focus on the company. And for a couple of years, I did pretty much just InCheck. Mm-hmm. I just was growing the company. And so I think, one of the things I wanted to discuss is the power of vision and dedication, where you have, you know what the end goal is and you kind of work backwards from there and stay committed to the end goal and flexible and open to the opportunities as they come along. I don't want to give people the idea that, you can just start something and run away from it. You have to put the time and effort and commitment into it. When I started training with the Cirque du Soleil acrobats, that supplemented I've always been athletic. So that became my new workout, spending an hour a day working out, as opposed to doing P90X, which I did a couple of times, or going to the gym or whatever. So that supplemented that. And of course I got really excited about it because I always get excited about new things. I don't want to kind of give the impression that you can run off and do eight different things at once and you're going to do really well at all of them. You can do eight different things, but you have to take the right amount of time and focus and put it into each thing at a time.
One thing you learned from working at Cirque du Soleil, you told Jeremy, our producer, is that you've got to commit 100%. You learned that from handsprings. How do handsprings teach you to focus 100% and commit 100%?
For Cirque du Soleil, I want to clear this up. I train with some acrobats who work for Cirque du Soleil. So they decided to teach me gymnastics and so forth. The back handspring thing. Man, back handsprings and I just don't really get along that well. I'm kind of inconsistent with them. But I learned that when I do it 100%, I land on my feet. And when I do it 92%, I land on my head. So that's kind of the thing with acrobatics. You have to do it all or nothing. And
why?
I think that's it. Why? I think other than the obvious physical reasons of you have to put the right power into the movement, if you're doubting yourself as you're doing it, that translates to the muscles. And you're going to do things to try to protect yourself. And actually, those things don't protect you. They injure you. So, for example, with a back handspring, if you throw yourself into it and do it correctly, the move just works. But if I'm hesitating and second guessing and having fear before I do it, that translates into the muscles and it doesn't come off the right way. They don't fire correctly. You don't land on your feet, land on your head.
So the muscles, instead of being directed towards getting you to land on your feet, those muscles are partially being directed towards protecting you, which then keeps you from landing on your feet and gets you to land on your head.
Really interesting paradigm to look at in terms of fear and how we work with fear, right? Because fear is designed to protect us, but too many people use fear in a way that ends up hurting them more. So, for example, let's translate that to business. Mm-hmm. I mean, I decided to throw myself into the company when I was, making the decision to go into it. Yeah, you were asking about going into doing cold calls and door-to-door and things like that. If I went in with fear, it came across in the presentation. I was stuttering. I was unsure. Just like with the acrobatics, I had to just use that fear as a motivator, not as a block.
How to use fear as a motivator when you're nervous about going in and talking to customers who never heard you before, or potential customers who never heard of you.
I think the key is to just make a decision that you're just going to do it. And once you make that decision and you're clear on the commitment, the rest seems to just fall into place. So,
and then you're able to just get rid of all the doubt when you're talking to them, just put it all aside and say, no, I'm here to talk to them.
Yes and no. I mean, the thing is it's still there, but it can be put aside to where you don't notice as much. You don't pay as much attention. It was like when I was a paramedic, right? Mm-hmm. I remember my very first call. One of the reasons I went into EMS was I wanted to learn how to stay really calm under pressure. And my martial arts teacher did that by his bodyguarding work. And I did it through EMS. And so I remember my very first call when I was out with a preceptor. I was the first time on the street, and it was a call that went real bad, real fast. I was shaking inside. I mean, I was really nervous. And afterwards, he said to me, he's like, wow, you really kept your head together. And I thought, well, no, I really didn't. But I did, because I was able to just get in the moment, focus on the goal and the task at hand, and push off the emotions until afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same thing with approaching somebody for business, same thing with acrobatics, the same thing with, you know, dealing with a car accident that's, you know, gone really wrong and things like that. So, one of the keys is being able to stay calm, I think, is to be able to connect into the center of now, into the moment, and sort of an intense moment-to-moment decision-making process, which just happens naturally when you can just be here and not somewhere else where the fear is. But if you're worrying about something, it's not actually happening. It's the nature of worry.
I've got a screenshot here of the left margin of your website where it says, where you list the different services that you offer. Card services and merchant accounts. We talked about that. High risk account management, bad checks, remote check deposit collections. We talked so far about the bad checks and merchant accounts. What's the next biggest source of revenue for you guys of all these?
I mean, collections would fall next, because that's really our third service.
How'd you get into collections?
Not something I ever thought I'd be doing. I was interviewing for an account manager's assistant, which was like an $11 an hour job. Mm-hmm. And I got a resume from somebody who had all this senior management experience in a collections agency. And at the time, we were outsourcing our bad checks that we couldn't collect electronically to collections agencies. And they were terrible. I mean, they just weren't collecting anything. And she leaves me this voicemail. She says, I realize I might be overqualified, but I want to come in and talk to you anyway. And I said, okay, come on in. By the way, is it getting dark here? Can you still see me?
I don't know. It seems okay.
Cool. I'll stay a little closer. I know the sun's going down. And she came in, and she was semi-retired from her previous job. She was collecting mortgages for the FDIC and so forth, and all this collections experience, and was looking for something to do. And I thought, this is perfect, because she knows the industry. We can collect our own bad checks in-house that we can't recover electronically. And this is a fantastic opportunity, and she wants to do it for her own reasons. She wants to work here for her own reasons. And I jumped on that one, and she's still with us, and she's fantastic.
Wow. And that's how you got started, by hiring a person and from there building this whole service.
You know, it's her service. She handles the whole thing. It's her department, and she's an expert.
I want to do a quick plug for Mixergy Premium and then come back and ask you a question that has nothing to do with business, but I think is still important. And the plug for Mixergy Premium, I think most of you who've listened know that at Mixergy Premium, we have over 800 interviews with entrepreneurs who tell you the stories of how they built their businesses. Once you're a member, you can go in and download any one of those interviews, listen to it, and get another and another and another. And if you notice at the top of this interview that Don's life was impacted by listening to a tape of someone who opened his eyes to a new possibility for himself, then maybe you remember in your own life how listening to certain people opened you up to new possibilities and let you grow. And that's the goal here for Mixergy, to give you more and more of those opportunities by listening to proven entrepreneurs share what's possible in their lives and in your lives and your life. If you're listening and you haven't signed up, go to MixergyPremium.com right now and join. Get access to all that great stuff. And if you're not, if you're already a member, go in and just start downloading, listen to them, and let it impact your life. MixergyPremium.com. I guarantee it.
Before you ask a question, can I help you plug that?
Because yes, please.
I think the power of, for me, like I said, I've been really lucky to have these mentors in my life from a young age, and there's always a little nugget. There's always something that sticks with me. There was another case before, a few years before I started the business. I was in a martial arts class. I was sitting in the back, and the teacher said to the class, he was talking to his senior students at the time, and I was just listening in, and he said, if you need more money, start a business. And that stuck with me from, I think I was 17 or something. So I think, you know, things like these stories on Mixergy or my Brian Tracy tape or the comments that my mentors made to me offer little golden nuggets of possibility opening. And you hear them, and I had no idea how to start a business, but I knew that that sounded interesting, and I held on to it until the universe sent me the right opportunity.
Wow. Yeah, and it's not exactly listen to the tape and life changes automatically. It's the thoughts in your head. And when the possibility presents itself that you can act on with that thought, you're there.
Ready for it. Too many people are not ready for opportunities that come along. And the universe is constantly sending us opportunities. You have to be ready to embrace them. And I think the way to do that is to know what your vision is, know that you want to get to a certain place, and then be open as those opportunities come in and those little nuggets of wisdom open your mind.
So that's something that you've said throughout this interview. Know what your vision is, and you have a vision for yourself. How do you do it? Is it formal, or is it just something that you keep in the back of your head? How do you get in touch with your vision? Sorry?
I've written my visions out, you know, and they change, the things that I want. But I think, you know, really a lot of this is, now we're talking about how manifestation works. How do you manifest something? And I think there's a few different factors to how you make something a reality. The first one is you have to have an idea of what it looks like. You have to, in your mind, have a visual representation of what is it that I want? What is it that it looks like? You may not know exactly how it's going to look, but you may know you want a new car. You may know that you want a house in the mountains. You may know that you want to travel Europe. And have a visual depiction of that in your mind and hold on to it. Next step, I think, is getting it from the mind into reality. And there's a couple ways to do that. You can speak it to your friends and people that are important, or to yourself. You can write it out. You know, you've got to get it from your mind into physical reality. So that's where things like, okay, Brian Tracy says, pick a number that you want to make this year. And okay, it's in my head. I'm going to write it down. I'm going to put it somewhere where I'm going to not forget about it. You know, I'll put it up on people have vision boards. Things, all these things are tools for getting ideas from the mind into reality. And the third step is to take an actual action towards it. I've always been the kind of person that doesn't write out the action steps. I take a step. The next step becomes apparent. The next step. So as I take steps, the rest of the path kind of opens up. And I think those are the three keys to manifesting what you want.
So that's what you do. You have a visualization of what you want to do, and then you put it you go from mind to reality by either writing it down or talking to people, and then you take some steps, some action to make it start happening.
Sounds simple, but that's the basic process of manifesting something.
All right. Visualize it in your mind, bring it to reality somehow, and then take an action. It's a great place to leave it. Don, thank you so much for doing this interview. The website is incheck.net, incheck.net. And if people want to connect with you and say thank you for doing this interview, what's a good way for them to do that?
Call me or email me. My email is dons, at incheck.net. And my phone number is 917-546-0965.
You just gave out your phone number in the tape. I can't edit that out. You're okay with it?
Oh, you can't? Oops. I don't know how many people are going to see this.
We'll find out right now. It's all good, entrepreneurs and people. Do not just call. I would send an email and say thank you first before anything else. You and I have now gone back and forth for almost a year to book this interview. I think I called you only in case of emergency. Anyone who just calls out of the blue is kind of a jerk who's never gonna build a relationship.
And that's not my cell phone, so that's the office number.
Well, somehow I got straight to you when I called that. Anyway, thank you so much for doing that, and thank you all for being a part of the interview. Bye, guys.